Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 79. Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Oh yeah, we're brilliant.
Yeah, if you need a really, really tall blonde person, I'm your woman.
This is Lou Anders, editorial director of Pirate Book.
This is Tracy Hickman.
This is Sean Williams.
And now, your host. Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. My name is Sean Farrell, and today I'm joined by James Eng, author of Blood of Ambrose. And it's a novel I mentioned in the last episode, episode 78. So here he is. James is going to talk to us about the novel and the inspiration behind it. But before we get to that, I have some news to correct, and I have a very cool contest to announce. So if you want to win a free book, don't tune out. Listen up. Pay attention. Okay, now first off, was very excited and thrilled with the reception that we got from episode 78, which ended our long hiatus. Thank you very much for the emails, the tweets, the many blog posts on the show notes for episode 78. It's good to be back, and it feels really good to know that so many people are engaged and excited about what we're trying to do with this show. So thank you again. Now, in episode 78, I incorrectly reported something, so I need to make this correction. I posted this on the website, but if you don't go there, then you didn't see the correction. So I said that Abyss and Apex, get that out, had closed. And that's not true. They have not closed. Abyss and Apex is simply closed to submissions right now, but they plan to reopen just next month, I believe, in August. So that's good news. There's another magazine out there. And thanks to Steven for the tip, who caught my mistake on that. And by the way, if you haven't read Steven's book reviews in the reviews section of the website, you're really missing out. So check out, go to the reviews page, click on it. In fact, the newest review on there right now is Steven's, and he reviews some audio short fiction. So go check it out. We also asked for your feedback on short fiction, and several people went ahead and did that in the blog post for the show notes of episode 78. So what short fiction do you read? Do you have a favorite author, a favorite magazine, a favorite e-zine, whatever it is, a favorite podcast? Drop on by, hit the show notes for episode 78 under the show section, and join in the discussion. Love to hear, or I guess I say I would love to see what everyone is reading and what everyone's enjoying. All right, so on to the contest here before we bring James on. We have 5 copies of Norse Code written by Greg Van Eekout available for you. That's right. 5 copies of Norse Code ready for you to win. So what do you have to do? Well, you heard Greg in episode 78, and I hope it helped to whet your appetite to check out the book. And here's what I would like to do. To win your free copy of Norse Code, all you have to do are 3 things. And by the way, you can find these instructions on the website if you forget any of the details. Number 1, you need to write a blog post. Now, what must the blog say? It can say whatever you want, but somewhere in there, you need to incorporate 2 pieces of information to qualify for the contest. First, you need to say that the Adventures of Sci-Fi Publishing Podcast is back in production. That'd be good, yeah. And second, you need to say that our first episode back features Greg Van Eekout, author of Norse Code, and then include a link in there so that your followers, readers, and friends can check out the book, can check out the interview, okay? So that's it. Write a blog, mention the show, mention Greg and the title Norse Code, and you qualify. Now, Sean, some of you are saying, what if I don't have a blog? Well, probably, if you're listening to a podcast, most of you are new media savvy, so you probably do have a blog. Or a MySpace page, or Facebook, they both have blog applications, so that certainly works. And if you don't have any of that, I guess it's time to start. Or you could ask a friend to post the blog for you, and then just hope that your friend actually gives you the book, if your friend's name is selected. Now, we've run contests a variety of different ways before, but this is how we're going to run this one. So if you don't have a blog, MySpace, or Facebook, you're out of luck unless you want to start one. It'd be a good time to do it. The last thing you need to do once you post the blog is send an email to me at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com with a link to your blog post. This is how you get entered into the drawing. So if you do the blog and you have the links on there, but you don't send me the email, then I'm not going to know about it, so I can't include you in the drawing. So this is important. Make sure you include your mailing address. That way Spectra knows where the book needs to go, okay? I will notify the winners by email, then I'll read the names on the show, and if your blog is selected, I'll put the link for your blog on our website as well. The contest ends midnight, July 31st. You have about 3 weeks to get this done. All right, details again if you need it, available at adventuresinscifipublishing.com. You can't miss it. I made a feature story out of it, so it will be the first graphic you see on the website. I hope you're excited. Norse code, up for grabs. Start the blogging, let's spread the word. And I'll be back with James Ng right after this.
They were abominations, genetically altered undesirables. They were prisoners of war, the final six of an advanced enemy. They were under our control, we hoped. They were our slaves for a time. They were powerful beyond our comprehension. They were children, and they wanted to be free.
From Tor Books, The Silver Ship in the Sea is a novel of high-concept science fiction from author Brenda Cooper. Visit the world of Fremont, where the dangers of volcanic eruptions, deadly vegetation, and hungry predators are only matched by the hatred of its citizens and the hidden power of six children. Can they escape oppression, or will hatred and fear destroy them? Find The Silver Ship in the Sea in bookstores everywhere and visit brenda-cooper.com to learn more about the novel Booklist Calls, an exciting coming-of-age story with a strong message about the evils of prejudice.
Fremont is our home, a home for the pure, and we are going to keep it that way.
And welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. And today we'll be focusing on the latter with fantasist James Ng, whose novel Blood of Ambrose was recently published by Pyre and one that I very much enjoyed reading. So it's good to have him on the show. Welcome, James.
Hey, thanks.
And like I said, I just finished reading the book, and I'm not trying to kiss up to you just because you're on the phone. Okay, I swear, I really did like it and could have put it down.
That's great to hear.
But before we talk about the novel, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your writing history, when you got started writing fiction, that kind of thing, who inspired you, and so forth.
Well, I've been writing since forever. You know, I read Tolkien like everyone else as a kid, and I immediately started this five-volume epic because they took too seriously this notion that he wrote somewhere in the introduction that he thought the book was too short. So I thought, I won't make that mistake, so I was going to write a five-book novel. And of course, I only got like 10 or 12 pages into it and walked away from it. But that was the beginning, I think. From that point on, I realized that books were written by people, and I was a person, and I could write them. So on and off for years, I was writing something or another. The first draft of A Morlock Story was written in the margins of a notebook while I should have been paying attention to the trigonometry professor in the front of the room. So it took forever to get published, because when I was starting to submit seriously in the early 80s, the magazines were turning away pretty strongly from the kind of adventure fantasy that I was interested in writing. So I kept on writing it anyway, which might not have been a shrewd career move, but has worked out in the end, I guess.
Now, I thought you were going to say you had a hard time getting it published because they got tired of editing out all the trigonometry. But
I didn't submit it on the square graph paper, but I was the worst typist in the world, and it was it was an incredible revelation the first time I typed in a word processor. I never looked back. I'm not a technophile. I'm not an early adopter of any technology, but it's unbelievably difficult to write coherently for me with a typewriter. The noise alone drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm. The click, click, click.
Right.
When you talk about reading that line from Tolkien, how old were you when you read that and when you first started writing this?
Well, let's see. I was in second grade, so I would have been 7 or 8.
Okay, I suspected it was rather young from the way you put that. And I've noticed that with most of the people I interview. It's like they started writing when they were 4.
I think it's not a bad thing to start when you're really young. But it doesn't surprise me now that it took a long time to get published. For one thing, like I say, there was a market shift. And if I'd been writing adventure fantasy books, the 80s might have been a good time to try that. But the adventure fantasy short market was dying or even dead. The thing is, though, that it's not surprising that it takes some people, including me, I guess, a while to bloom as fiction writers, because you have to have lived a little. You have to have been out there. You have to have, you know, had someone break up with you and, you know, lose your job and do all the wander around and do all the different stuff that accumulates experience that you can make fiction out of. Hmm. In fantasy, that might seem less important than in realistic fiction. I think that's a misnomer, but let's let it lie. The thing is, though, that even fantasy is made out of real life. That's one of Tolkien's big discoveries. So I think that just to amass the experience, for some people anyway, it takes a while for that stuff to percolate through.
So you started writing this series, or your book, I should say. And tell us the story about how it got picked up and finally got published.
Let's see. When my wife was pregnant with our first kid, our son, I had this idea for this Morlock story. He's wandering around in the woods and somebody steals a book and he goes after it. And I wrote it and I started submitting it places. And time passed. And 16 years later, I heard about this new magazine, Blackgate, that was interested specifically in adventure fantasy, the kind of stuff that I was writing. So I sent them this story. And John O'Neill bought it. That was in 2005. Hmm. And after he bought that story and a couple others, I figured it was a natural segue to start writing a novel at that point.
So the novel came together pretty quickly then.
Yeah, I had been thinking about it as writing the stories over the years, because I always figured I'd establish a record as a short story writer, then work on getting a book published, which is the way I guess it used to go. But now it might make more sense to go straight for book publishing if you're interested in writing books. But the novel had been in the back of my mind as a set of possibilities, so it did fit together pretty quickly.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the novel a little bit. Can you, first off, tell us about the setting and about the mythology behind it and a little bit about your research process?
Sure. Let's see here. It's about a war for succession in this imaginary kingdom, which I guess makes it sound like half the book's on the shelves at the moment. the deal is that Morlock Ambrosius and his family are extremely long-lived, so they live centuries while other people live normal lifespans around them. And his sister, Ambrosia Viviana, is extremely politically minded, and she grew up wanting to rule the world. And when she grew up, she actually made a good job of ruling a big chunk of it. And she establishes this dynasty of an empire that rules a big chunk of what they think of as the world. And time passes, centuries pass, and her descendants, take power, wield power, die, and then the next generation comes along. But by the time she's getting a little old to keep up on guiding the empire, there's an opportunity for a usurper to sneak in and try and take over. And the novel starts in the middle of that process when the usurper is killing off all the people who've been loyal to the old emperor the heir to the throne is just a young kid, and he's caught in the middle of this struggle between much more ancient, much more powerful people, and he's confused by it. He's the viewpoint character for most of the novel. And Morlock becomes involved because his sister Ambrosia gets endangered by this power grab by the usurper, or the guy named Erdven, the guy who's the protector of the young emperor-to-be.
You know, Morlock, I love his entrance when he comes in the first time. I don't want to spoil it for the readers. but I'm wondering, was he based on any historical figure, or did you just completely make up everything there is about Morlock?
Well, yes and no. I firmly believe in Tolkien's notion of subcreation, that everything that you create is made out of something else. And Morlock is definitely made out of something else. For one thing, his name is stolen, right? It's stolen from H.G. Wells, mm-hmm. whose Morlock characters at the end of time, they're the subterranean maker race, and they're evil and they eat people. And then there are the Eloi, who live above ground and are stupid as vegetables, but they're pretty. And Wells sides with the Eloi and wants us to like them. But I like the Morlocks. I mean, they did stuff. They worked for a living. They just didn't sit around in a garden and wait for them to bring them flowers and vegetables. I mean, they did stuff. And I felt like Wells sort of cheated by weighing the scales against the Morlocks. And I love the book. I love The Time Machine. I love Wells' early novels, all of them, because they're a riot. But I don't like it when an author too obviously tries to tip the scales of the readers. So that bugged me. And it also bugged me that Tolkien did the same thing in Lord of the Rings, made us want to, or tried to make us like the elves better than the dwarves. So Morlock is sort of born out of that discontent with two of my favorite authors. And then when I was reading Arthurian mythology, I noticed that the name Morlock looked a lot like a bunch of the names, the Celtic names, especially from the Arthurian mythos, like Morgan and Mordred and Morgause and Morholt, who's an enemy of Tristan. So I figured that Morlock Ambrosius would be connected somehow with the Arthurian stories, probably as the son of Merlin, the equivalent of Mordred for Arthur. And that's how he came to be, although that Arthurian stuff has gone way in the background.
It is in the background, but it's certainly there. And in fact, Merlin, I hope this isn't a spoiler.
No, it's not at all.
Okay. He does make an appearance in the book, and it's an unexpected and unusual appearance. In fact, I've never seen, not that I'm a Merlin expert or anything, but I haven't seen Merlin portrayed quite the way that he's portrayed here. Can you talk about what you did with Merlin, and is it very different than what's been done before, or am I just missing stuff?
No, I think it's a way different Merlin. I mean, the typical Merlin would be something like the Merlin in T.H. White's The Once and Future King, which is a wonderful set of books. I'm not knocking them at all. But there, he's kind of an absent-minded, kindly sorcerer figure. The trouble is that if I did that with my Merlin, it would just be T.H. White's Merlin in drag. So I didn't want to do that. Also, Morlock is screwed up. He's a drunk. He's got all sorts of problems, and I wanted to establish a conflict between Morlock and Merlin as not a complete explanation, but as a partial explanation for that sort of weirdness in Morlock's character. So there had to be some kind of hostility between them. And plus, I just like writing really hostile characters, and Merlin in that book and in the sequel, This Crooked Way, is a pretty sinister figure, but a very urbane sinister figure.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he's not like Sauron, never appears.
Yeah,
he's in the forefront of trying to do stuff that he thinks is important and is worthwhile to him, but he doesn't care who he hurts to get it done. And if one of his kids or anyone else is in the way, he'll just run right over him. That makes him a very sinister figure, but on the other hand, he thinks of himself as the hero, so he can be very charming and urbane, at least as he sees it.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. When you were mentioning H.G. Wells, and the Morlocks. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned their taste for flesh. It made me think of some of the horror elements that are in this book as well. And you know, the more I didn't really realize this until I was explaining the book to a friend of mine, how gruesome some of the stuff is that's in this book. And I think it's because you don't dwell on it. You present it like here's what they're doing, and the characters react, but then you move on. So there's not pages upon pages of describing these gory things happening. But can you talk about the horror elements and how much you wanted to bring the horror into it, and whether or not that was inspired by Wells also?
Part of it, I wasn't thinking of Wells so much at that point, but just the tradition of sword and sorcery in general. Most people agree that there is a horror element in sword and sorcery from the beginning. I mean, Howard is writing the original sword and sorcery stories, whether you think they're the Solomon Kane stories or the Conan stories or whatever. Everyone agrees that Robert E. Howard invented the genre. And he's publishing those stories in Weird Tales, which is a horror magazine. And there's always a horror element to the stories. Mm. And Fritz Leiber, who in my opinion is the greatest writer of sword and sorcery, he carries that on in the Lankmar stories. And there's always some eerie, weird element to those stories. So I kind of figure like it was hardwired into the genre. But it's also a story about, I'm not sure how to put this exactly. It's a story of an empire and kings and thrones and all that junk. But it's also a story of a really screwed up family. And the horror elements somehow served, for me anyways, as a reader as well as the writer of the book, to sort of shock a reaction, an emotional reaction that was deeper than rationality, so that some of that emotional material could be played with. Mm-hmm. So that people would pay attention, not just with their mind to the words, but with their emotions to the images.
And I think that works really well too, in that you have a good sense of humor. And in one paragraph, I'm laughing about something that was in there, and then something totally wrong is happening in the next paragraph, and the juxtaposition of it really highlights the horrific act that's taking place. Would you say this is more of a Leiber fantasy then, and not in the Tolkien school so much?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I love Tolkien, as must be obvious by now, but I really like Leiber's tradition of, you know, these guys are wisecracking as they're facing these horrors. Fafnir and the Grey Mouser are always trying to one-up each other, and the Grey Mouser usually wins if it's verbal, but they're full of humor as well as horror. And I feel with Leiber that the two complement each other and that they go perfectly well with each other. Leiber, in addition to being a great sword and sorcery writer, was a great writer of modern urban horror. He practically invented the genre, and he does really well at that mixing of humor and horror. And to me, it seemed perfectly natural. Some people are shocked by it, or if not shocked, shocked might be putting it too strongly, but they object to it.
Right.
One person I was reading was objecting to the fact that there was this attempt by the big bad guy to kill the hero, and within a couple of minutes, they're making a sort of joke about another matter entirely. But I don't know. To me, it felt right.
I also think
when you...
Oh, go ahead.
When bad things happen, you kid about them. It's a way to relieve tension for the people involved. That's why it seems kind of realistic to me rather than otherwise.
I think I read that review also. I think we read the same one. The person objecting to the use of humor there. And one thing that I think the reviewer missed there is, to me, when they were using humor after these very stressful and terrorizing things were happening, not only is it a defense mechanism to cope with what's happening, but it showed to me how experienced they were. It showed to me that these people are hundreds of years old. They've been through a lot.
It wasn't their first rodeo.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that, I don't know. I've never faced war or anything comparable to it, so what do I know? But the guys who've been there and come back, they're without making light of the experience at all, they show that not taking it too seriously or being able to joke about it is one of the ways in which you deal with it. Like I say, I know this stuff through research. I've never been there.
Yeah. Well, I think it works. In fact, it helped break the tension for me. It kept it fun and without making it too serious.
Good deal.
But, you know, one thing I want to talk about, too, and this fits, since we're talking about the difference between Tolkien and Library Fantasy, is the structure of it. And this felt like it had a very organic structure to me. You know, the Tolkien model, and I don't mean to be speaking down about this structure, but generally there's a problem, and then there's a quest to solve the problem, and often there has to be an acquisition of a particular relic or artifact, and that is the goal of said quest. And along the journey, we learn more about the characters and the world and the mythology and so forth. But this book takes place almost completely in one city and the surrounding areas. So it's like I kept waiting for this fantasy quest, but which, to be quite honest, I don't really care for very much. So I was glad that the traditional fantasy quest never really came.
I do think that not all fantasies follow the same pattern, but... Right. A lot of them do seem to have that sort of setup. And world building, what people call world building, seems to be more like a travelogue in which you go from place to place to place, and they're all described in detail, whether mm-hmm. they have anything to do with the plot or not.
Right.
And it seems to me that world building is something that has to happen first. You build your world, and then you set your story in it. And you can make changes to your world as you go. But the point of the story should not be to have a let's-go Middle Earth sort of experience, the Fodor's Guide to Middle Earth, but to tell a story. And stories are about conflict. And I also like to cut to the chase a lot. So I skip over a few years here and there rather than narrating every step of the plot.
Which I thank you for, by the way.
Well, I didn't want to make it into a three-book book. I think that there, you know, when you've got enough story to fill three volumes, and there's no question that Tolkien did, I think it's great. But I think that there's a definite trend for the middle book to be full of filler.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the story is set up in the first book and concluded somewhere past the middle of the second book, and I just don't see the point of that. Why not skip over the stuff that doesn't directly impact the plot?
Exactly. And I've said on this show before that I don't read as much fantasy as science fiction because so much fantasy is big, long series.
Mm-hmm.
And I could read 5 or 8 or 10 books in a series, or I could read 5 or 8 or 10 different authors, different, completely different
right.
worlds, and get a bigger taste for what's out there in the market. So I really love the fact that this was a complete story. But there is a sequel coming out, or is it a prequel? How is it connected, the next book?
Well, I guess it's a sequel because it begins in the year following Blood of Ambrose. And it involves Merlin also. He's more foregrounded in the next book than he was in the first book. What this Crooked Way is an episodic novel or fix-up or whatever you want to call it, which is a real traditional form in sword and sorcery books. You take a series of stories that were originally published in a magazine and you cobble them together as a novel, which sounds terrible. And some of them are terrible, I think. Sometimes you can ruin a good set of stories by trying to make them into a book.
Hmm.
But I sort of wrote these stories to be part of a continuous plot thread. And what I'm doing in this Crooked Way is giving people the beginning and end of the story and the middle parts that make people see, yes, in fact, these separate episodes are all part of one, story.
So do these contain some of these stories that were in Blackgate, that were published in Blackgate?
Right. Payment Deferred, the one where Morlach faces this golem maker in the corrupt city of Sarkundan, and the stories that follow from there, they're all part of the framework of this Crooked Way. But there's other stuff, too. Merlin has not appeared in any of those Blackgate stories, but he's a major character in the book. So it's not just like, oh, here I'm going to say something which sounds bad about a writer I really like, Lois Bujold, who writes this great set of space opera stories. She wrote a set of stories collected in, now I forget the name of the book, but anyway, she collected a bunch of stories and stitched them together with an intermediate set of interludes, and it was published as a novel, even though it was really a set of stories.
Right.
It's not a fix-up like that. It's actually conceived of as a continuous plot. It just has big, chunky episodes.
Okay.
Some people hate that.
Well,
some people want a continuous story, but I like the rhythm of a long story with shorter stories being concluded within it.
And that's kind of how Blood of Ambrose works. I mean, we have the story initially of Morlock coming back and trying to save the day. And then as we move through the years, as you said, you skip over some years in there. But
right.
it didn't feel like short stories to me. It still felt like one cohesive, connected story.
I thought of it that way, too. But some reviewers have said, this is great, but it's like a set of short stories. So there's a range of opinion there. There was one deliberate cleft I made in the plot, which was I wasn't sure that I could write a book as long as 120,000 words and have it be published. That's how out of touch I was with trends in fantasy publishing. I didn't realize that 120,000 words is actually, you know, a shortish novel, according to some people.
Right.
But anyway, I made a big break in the middle of the book because I figured that way maybe I could cut it in half and sell it as, you know, a duology. But nonetheless, that was plan B. Plan A was to have it appear in a single volume.
Now, when is book two going to hit the shelves?
October. I just turned in the galley proof pages. I was scared about it until I turned them in because it seemed like October was all too near. Mm-hmm. And now it seems so far away.
And how about any more? Are there any more books coming out in this universe?
Well, we signed a contract late last year, I think, for a third Morlock book, which is going to be called The Wolf Age, which I'm working on now. And it's set further in the north. It's another standalone, but it's set after this Crooked Way. And in it, Morlock falls into sort of a city of werewolves. He's taken prisoner by the werewolves and then fights his way free, and hilarious consequences ensue. But he ends up in the werewolf city during an election year. And I figured that werewolves wouldn't handle, you know, monarchy because they're not that organized. And they would probably not handle democracy that well either because they're not that peaceful. But there's a style of government called democracy where someone who has more social importance has a bigger vote. So it's one wolf, one vote in the werewolf city, but some votes weigh more than others. So
interesting.
And dominance is established by fighting and other forms of competition. So among other things, I figure it's a different setting for a fantasy novel. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of trouble I can get Morlock into in the middle of this timocratic democracy of werewolves during an election year.
Very cool. Well, I'm looking forward to them. As I said, I really enjoyed the first book. And it, folks, you can go get it now, Blood of Ambrose, at your local bookstore. You should definitely go check it out. And James, is there anything else you wanted to mention about the book that I didn't ask?
There must be, but there's always something I forget, so that this will have to be it.
Well, and people can check out your website, which is?
JamesEng.com, predictably. But I'm also on LiveJournal as James Eng, without a break, .livejournal.com.
And Eng is E-N-G-E, in case anyone's wondering
right.
how that's spelled.
Right. And if anyone pronounces it Ange or anything like that, that's okay with me.
And, of course, we'll have all these links in the show notes if anyone wants to check it out. So, James, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks so much, and thanks for your kind words about the book. I can't say how much that means to me.
Oh, well, I couldn't put it down, so you earned it.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for online interviews, book reviews, news stories, coverage of live events, videos, and much more. You can send us an email at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and give us a call at 206-350-5029. Music by Cargo Cult from their track Dirt, available at magnatune.com. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production.
To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.